Hello and welcome to Backchat from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM. That's 103.2 FM up in Preston. Nikki Radio in Hertfordshire and to our listeners in Swindon. Hello Swindon FM. Coming up in the show.
Now a quick flash from Abercrombie. Now a murmured, dry half-heard aside from Thomas. Now a clear laughing word from Brooke, and then again Frost's rich and ripe philosophy that had the body and tang of good draught cider and poured as clear as stream. 'Twas in July of 1914 that we sat and talked.
A line there from Wilfred Gibson, the Dymock Poets Remembered. We visit Dymock to meet the custodian of the Garden Hut Memorial to the poets. I'm Kirsty Paul.
And I'm James Melia.
So when we receive through the post something stamped as HMRC, it can put us into a spin and cast fear into our hearts. But that's not always the case. We have with us today Sarah Bamford from HM Revenue and Customs to talk about income tax. Now, last time you were in, we were talking about tax evasion and tax avoidance, weren't we, Sarah?
That's right, yes.
Fabulous. So you're going to take us a little bit through the history of income tax and how it applies to our lives.
That's right. I've been doing a little bit of research about the history of income tax. And despite working for HM Revenue and Customs for over 30 years, I didn't actually know very much about the history of tax. So I've done a little bit of research and I'm going to share with you some of the things that I found. For example, income tax was introduced in 1799, and it was introduced as a means of paying for the war against Napoleon.
My goodness, wow.
So that was something I didn't know.
Absolutely.
It was introduced by William Pitt the Younger, and it was introduced as a temporary tax.
And is it still a temporary tax?
It is still a temporary tax.
So if we lobbied government enough, does that mean we'd be able to get rid of it?
Well, I can't answer that question, but what I can say is it does have to be renewed every year.
Every year.
So it's something that in theory, presumably, each year a different decision could be made as to whether or not it's going to continue.
And do you think the government would get taxed if they weren't to renew that every year?
Well, I suppose the Treasury has to get its money from somewhere.
Absolutely. So if not one tax, then another. Yes,
possibly,
absolutely.
yes. So income tax was introduced to pay for the war. And actually, with the research that I've been doing, it's been used over the years to pay for wars. It's often, when it was introduced, it was very unpopular, as I'm sure you can understand.
Yes, of course.
It started off at 10%, and you had to have an income of over £60.
Over £60. Before. So anything you earned
over
£60,
you'd get to pay the 10% on that. This was back in, obviously, in 1799. So I'm sure that lots of people, whilst I don't know what the average wage was in 1799, I'm sure there were lots of people probably who earned £60 a year or less. You know, wages obviously back then could have been pretty low. It raised, when it was introduced, it raised £6 million a year, which is quite a lot. I did try to apply the rate of inflation going backwards all those years, but of course the figures aren't available. But I think you could probably times that by many, many times to get today's equivalent. So as I mentioned, there was the war with Napoleon, then there was a peace treaty, so the tax was repealed because it was no longer needed because we were no longer at war with Napoleon. However, these things have a tendency not to last for very long, and there was renewed fighting, so it was repealed but then replaced very quickly in 1803, and that was the foundation really of the tax and the income tax sort of it that we've got in place today. When income tax was reintroduced, it was reintroduced at half the previous rate, so it was at 5%, so obviously reduction there. But it didn't last long, that 5%. By 1806, the rate had increased to 10%, back to the original figures.
So we're seeing a natural tendency towards 10% then?
Certainly back in those times, certainly, yes. So income tax was repealed again It was repealed with a thundering peal of applause, and Parliament decided that all documents connected with it should be collected, cut into pieces and pulped. So I think that gave... That maybe gives an impression of how people felt about income tax at the time.
Its popularity.
Or not. But I think what they did establish was that it was actually a very practical way of raising money that was needed for raising revenue that the government of the time needed. By the mid-1800s, there was a significant change in sort of the social and economic climate. Child labour was limited, slavery was ended, parliamentary reform. There was all sorts of things. You know, the world was a very fast-changing place. You know, lots of things were happening. The general election in 1841, Robert Peel became the Prime Minister. And although he had previously opposed income tax, the pots in the coffers, they were all empty. There was a growing deficit and there was a surprise return of income tax in 1842. So, you know, it's come, it's gone, and, you know, once again, it's back again. That time, Peel sought to tax only people who had an income of more than £150. And there was also some duty on some other goods reduced. So the less wealthy benefited, and trade. It also had the sort of positive impact of reviving trade and everything.
So responding to the calls that the government is hearing at the moment to tax the rich, that's when it came back at that time. That was a definite tax on the rich rather than on the poor then.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, the less wealthy benefited, you know, so, you know, there are often changes which mean that some people pay more and some people pay less. Mm-hmm. That tax was imposed for 3 years with the possibility of a 2-year extension. But then there were all sorts of other things, railways increasing, national expenditure, all sorts of things happening. You know, as I said, the world was very much a changing place.
Absolutely. Industrial revolution, yes. Need for investment.
That's right. Exactly. And as I said, it was a temporary tax. And it's still, to this day, is still a temporary tax. And every year, Parliament has to reapply by an annual finance bill. So, like you say, who knows what might happen in the future. When income tax was introduced, there were government-appointed commissioners, and these were usually the landed gentry, and they were responsible for administering and collecting taxes. And surveyors had what they called a watching brief. Surveyors are now inspectors of taxes. So, you know, the titles have changed a little bit, but some of the roles haven't necessarily changed.
Thanks to Sarah Bamford there from HMRC. On to sustainability. Are we doing enough for the environment? Bristol, it seems, is setting a good example to the rest of Britain in this field and has even found some recognition in Europe. So in the studio, we have Darren Hall from the Bristol Green Capital Partnership. Welcome, Darren.
Thank you very much. Yeah, great to see you.
You'll be talking us through a little bit of information about the Bristol Green Capital Partnership and especially focusing on the European Green Capital Award, I understand.
That's right, yeah.
So the Bristol Green Capital Partnership, when was that set up and can you give us a bit more information about what you do?
Sure. Well, it started quite a few years ago, really, with some of the people like Alistair Sorday and George Ferguson, of course, who's now our new mayor, came to Bristol 30, 40 years ago and really working on keeping Bristol a green place. And then about 10 years ago, Europe, Brussels, started to say, actually, if we're going to be green and sustainable, it needs to start in our cities. And they set up a competition called the European Green Capital Competition. And Bristol was one of the first cities who entered in 2008 for the 2010 award. And slight to people's surprise, to be honest, we were shortlisted. We were in the first group of people to be shortlisted. And that really got the partnership going. More recently, the last Lib Dem administration put some money behind it. My job was put in place, and the partnership's been going from strength to strength.
So Are you directly allied to the Green Party?
No. I say not at all, but of course there's lots of things that we do which are in keeping with some of the things that the Green Party says. But then we were heavily supported by the Labour administration and then the Lib Dem administration. And really, whenever we do major things like the European Green Capital, we're looking for cross-party support. Because sustainability isn't a political issue. It's something that everybody's got to do, irrespective. It's really quite disappointing, actually, when the politicians use it to score points off each other. Some of the stuff at national level at the moment is ridiculous. I hope more and more people are starting to wake up to the fact that this is a global issue, never mind a green or a blue or a yellow issue. You know, it's of national importance.
And about what we can do locally.
Absolutely. I mean, things start at home. I mean, the Green Capital Partnership is founded upon a real kind of community bottom-up approach. Most of our projects are very local. Growing schemes, energy schemes on a local basis, Bristol Pound, all sorts of very local stuff. But I think we're now pushing towards needing to reach the tipping point. So to make green normal, not just this marginal activity that, you know, lentils and hippies do over in the corner. This is about core stuff. Transport, energy, infrastructure, planning. We really need to start thinking about it on a citywide scale, so across the whole country.
So making sure you've got a presence in everything, sustainability is a key consideration for anything that's being done within a city.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the European competition looks at 12 different subjects, and they're things that you might expect, like transport and waste, water consumption, energy, our climate change targets. It goes across the whole of the spectrum, jobs especially.
So this is the European Green Capital Award that you're referring to.
Yes.
And I understand Bristol did quite well last year.
Yeah, not bad. There were 18 cities went in last year. We were shortlisted, still the only UK city to have been shortlisted. Last year, Newcastle and Stoke-on-Trent went into the competition as well. I won't say where they came. That'd be very unfair of me. But we were shortlisted along with Copenhagen and Frankfurt. And went over to Brussels and nearly won it. But Copenhagen were excellent. Their technical scores are amazing. But we kind of nearly caught up. We got some very, very good feedback saying, look, you really ought to enter again next year. So we did. So we're back in. Our technical submission's gone in October. And we now have to wait until about April to find out if we've been shortlisted again. Then we have to go over to Brussels to do a presentation on what we would do if we won. And we find out on June the 14th next year. Yeah.
So 6 months to wait. So that's been spearheaded by the Bristol Green Capital Partnership then?
Yes. Yeah. Lots of it is with the council. So most of the things that happen in the city to do with this are controlled by the council. So 10 out of the 12 sections are largely to do with council stuff. But we also worked a lot with Bristol Water because they supply the water to houses across Bristol. And then Wessex Water are the other end of the outgoing water. So we work with them as well. But the partnership is the kind of membership organisation that brings it all together and works on behalf of Bristol. So we like to think we're independent of any of the other organisations and we try and get everybody to collaborate on it.
Obviously, you mentioned Copenhagen did very well last year in the European Green Capital Awards. Are you working with them or with any other cities to understand, you know, where you could share your hard-won findings? Because if Bristol is doing the best in the UK, obviously we want to expand out those great learnings.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's really interesting that I've been invited to already this year to Liverpool and to Brighton. That they were aware of what we were doing and they're going to catch up pretty quickly. They invited us up, the Chamber of Commerce said come and they want to set up a Green Capital Partnership. There are lots of places around the UK that have got green organisations, but we've got a much more citywide organisation that's doing some significant things. So yeah, Brighton and Liverpool, we're going to be talking to Derby soon. One of my colleagues went all the way up to Edinburgh recently to talk to them. But as it happens, one of the team has just been over to Copenhagen and met the team there. They're really excited to work with Bristol because they wanted to win and they did. But they absolutely said that there were things that they could learn from us that they don't have in Copenhagen and vice versa, particularly the community stuff, our social media and how many people around the city really get involved. Copenhagen said maybe they're not quite so good at that as we are.
So, that's very interesting.
Yeah, it's good to know, isn't it?
So things such as local radio. And that's very, very inspiring. And you mentioned, obviously, Bristol is standing head and shoulders at the moment. We've got a new mayor and we've also got the Bristol Pound. Has the Bristol Pound been part of the consideration of the Bristol Green Capital Partnership?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the kind of, it's really innovative. I mean, other places have done local pounds, Lewis Pound, Totnes Pound. The Bristol Pound really takes it another step. You know, they've got the text to pay system whereby you can use your mobile phone. So you don't even actually have to have Bristol Pounds in your wallet to be able to pay. So that's quite innovative. But the other bit was about making it citywide. So kind of reaching towards that tipping point. But Bristol Green Capital put some money in very early on because we recognised that it's a bit of a game changer, really, in helping people understand where their money goes. You know, when they go and spend it in these big chain shops, it disappears. Not only disappears outside Bristol, it disappears outside of the country. And hey, look at the news recently about people not paying tax.
Absolutely.
On their money. Whereas if you pay in Bristol pounds, you can absolutely be sure that that money is going to stay in circulation. Your local shopkeeper will then use it to buy vegetables from their supplier, and their supplier might use it to pay their business rates back to the council. The council then use it to fund a local project, and so on and so forth. And so that what the New Economics Foundation say is that a local currency is likely to stay in circulation 5 times longer than an ordinary pound. And that's really, really important for local economy and for local jobs and for local people.
Yeah, it's money sustainability really, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Oh, it's already the world's biggest local currency. £100,000 in circulation. Over 350 shops are now taking it, and more every week. It's astonishing. It's really amazing.
Thanks there to Darren Hall from Bristol Green Capital Partnership.
Our feature this week comes from Dimmock. Next year, Britain will be commemorating 100 years of the outbreak of World War I, the war to end all wars. The 20th century witnessed more wars happening across the globe than any other century, and with the development of sophisticated weaponry, more people killed by war than ever before. The number of people killed in the First World War was 16 million deaths, with 20 million wounded. The Second World War, 60 million dead, 2.5% of the world's population. The Korean War, about 2 million. The Vietnam War, around 2 million. The Yugoslav or Balkan War, 140,000. The Iraq War, approximately 1 million. Not to mention civil and tribal wars in Africa, the Middle East and Southeast Asia, the Cambodian Civil War and the Laotian Civil War. Near at home, the Spanish Civil War also claimed 500,000 lives. What made the First World War so different was that many young men who were not regular soldiers volunteered to go to war. Many were gifted young musicians, writers, artists and poets. Two of the Dimmock poets locked their lives in the Great War, Edward Thomas and Rupert Brooke. Ivor Gurney, poet and composer and a friend of the Dimmock poets, was wounded and shell-shocked. We're now going to hear one of his many beautiful piano pieces, followed by a visit to the Garden Hut, where an exhibition about the Dimmock poets is on display at Wrighton, a little hamlet near Dimmock, where Lascelles Abercrombie, himself a poet, lived at the gallows. Thank you.
I'm with Barbara Davis. Where are we going, Barbara?
Up the garden path.
She's leading me up the garden path. Why?
Well, to come and visit the Garland Hut.
So we're going in a garden shed, a large one, and here we are, a little museum to the Dymock poets.
Yes, that's right.
So did you have this specially built?
Yes, when the Friends of the Dymock Poets were formed, they set aside some money so that I could put the exhibition up, which told very briefly a history of the Dymock Poets. Those are the poets, those are the cottages they lived in, those are the walks that connect the cottages. Books to read, maps to look at, and...
How many poets were there in total?
There were six poets who came, and then there was a seventh poet, Eleanor Fargen, who was a good friend of the poet.
Who was the American?
Ah, that's Robert Frost. This is this gentleman here. And he came over to England to get published, because though he was writing poetry in America, he wasn't being published there, and I think he'd read some of Wilfred Gibson's poetry in America. He thought that if they were publishing that kind of stuff in England, then that's probably where he needed to be, because his poetry was about ordinary people, which is what Gibson wrote about. And
Robert Frost wrote a very famous poem.
More than one.
No, but the woods.
Yes, Two Roads Diverge in Yellow Wood, and that was written about his friend Edward Thomas. I think that happened in the wood near Red Marley.
And did Robert Frost ever go back to America?
Oh, yes. When he returned to America, he published books in England, which were reviewed by Lascelles Abercrombie and Edward Thomas. They were favourable reviews, and it really set him on the literary ladder to fame. When he went back to America, he was well known.
So the Dymock Poets really helped him in his career?
Yes, it helped him to, launch him.
So where did Edward Thomas live? Edward Thomas is now becoming quite a popular figure, isn't he, in poetry?
Right, it's interesting. I've been sort of with this subject since 1982, and when I first came to it, Rupert Brooke was the best known poet, this handsome young man, and he wrote the poem "If I Should Die, Think Only This of Me," and it was published at the gallows up the road.
Did they have a little printing press?
No. It was Abercrombie and his wife and Wilfred Gibson who, arranged the publication of new numbers. And you'll see in the books in the church, the new numbers, that it was from Brighton. They were distributed throughout the world, and the poem became popular very, very quickly. And it was read in St. Paul's Cathedral. I'm not sure about that.
How did Winston Churchill describe him? He became almost like an idol, didn't he, because he was so good-looking.
Oh, yes. He, in effect, represented the flower of youth that was killed in the First World War. He was described as the handsomest young man in Britain.
So how
he
many
was godlike, almost.
He's like a screen idol, isn't he?
Oh, yes.
So looking at the poets here, how many died in the First World War?
Right, two died. Edward Thomas, he died. He died in combat, and he died of a mosquito bite that turned to septicemia.
Edward Thomas had his lungs shattered, his shell exploded.
The blast of a shell, yes.
What about John Drinkwater? Do you know much about him?
Well, he was connected with Birmingham Repertory Company, and I think the friendship between Abercrombie and John Drinkwater might have developed because Abercrombie was writing verse drama because of the theatre connection. I think there was a negotiation or talk going on between them there.
Eleanor Fargen.
Oh, right. Now, she, bless her, chronicled everything. We would have been left without the story if Eleanor hadn't written it down.
But she wrote a famous poem about cats.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, she did. Cats sleep everywhere.
And the Abercrombies, they went to Liverpool, didn't they?
Abercrombie had Liverpool connections. He worked in Birkenhead.
The Dymock poets, has their popularity expanded over the years?
They've become better known, yes. As I explained earlier, Rupert Brooke was the most famous poet in the early 80s. And then the focus became Robert Frost. Lots of people were eulogising Frost poetry. But now the shift is towards Edward Thomas.
How many people make a special journey to come to see what the Dymock poets was about, actually come to Dymock and Wrighton and look at the cottages?
Well, a lot of people now are coming because of the exhibition in the back of the church. If they're agile, they walk Poets Path 1.
That's about 11 miles, isn't it?
No, it's about an 8-mile circular walk, yes. And very often I trap them with the garden and take them up the garden path. But
can you tell us about Kempley Old Church, which is near Dymock?
Kempley Old Church is now in the care of English Heritage, and a previous vicar discovered the paintings underneath the whitewash, and he had the foresight to get some of the best people in the country to uncover the frescoes, and they are very important frescoes. They're very old, and the timbers of the church roof are very old too, so it's well worth the detour to go and see that church.
Well, I'm here with the choir master from Dymock Church. Hello.
Hello. I've been at Dymock Church for 20 years. We arrived first week, and the second week I was in the choir, and about the third week I was the organist, and I've been here ever since. My involvement with the Dymock poets has been quite extensive, to the point where I've organised a number of concerts, and in particular some performances of some songs which I have set to music. I've entitled the 6 songs called Under an English Heaven, which, if you know your poems, is one of the Rupert Brooke's poems. And I attempt also to broaden the involvement in the community, specifically by involving children from Ancam Primary School, which is in Dymock, in performances. And they have embraced this quite readily and now have 3 of their houses named after Dymock poets.
So many of the poets went off to the First World War. Are you planning any special celebrations for 2014?
Personally, I will respond, and I want to certainly put on a performance of something which I want to write, which will involve the children and the adult choir. So I need to get my skates on with that fairly quickly. But yes, I shall be planning something for 2014.
What other interest do you get from choirs around the world or Europe because you are connected to the Dymock poets?
I can't say specifically that we have choirs coming readily to perform works which are directly related, though we do hold on a very regular basis concerts in the church. We normally attempt to organise an event which is sometimes a concert or a community musical evening once a month. There is a pretty strong pattern of involvement from the community. And of course, when the Friends of the Dymock Poets have their biannual meeting in October and the first week in April, we always attempt to coincide with that with some event of our own.
You play the organ in the church as well?
I do. It's quite a interesting 2-manual organ which was built in 1886 by John Nicholson, who was an organ builder based in Worcester. When I came, we had a number of issues with it, so in 2001 we launched an appeal to do some pretty extensive refurbishment, which was successfully undertaken, and it's now working more effectively but also with a more colourful registration, which I hope John Nicholson would approve of. Certainly we were specifically advised by the organ advisor, the diocesan organ advisor at that time, who gave us, I think, very good advice. So yes, it continues to be a concern. There are from time to time issues, and the most recent one was when the organ was ciphering rather badly, and still is. And that's as a result of a leaky roof, which I've just been to the church, and we now have a bill, facing a bill for some extensive roof repairs directly above the organ, which is a bit worrying.
So this is a common problem, isn't it, throughout Britain, all the old churches, the roofs?
Well, it is a very large ancient building, and strangely enough, the part of the roof which is badly in need of refurbishment dates back only to Victorian times, and we do find that there are kind of extensive stonework problems also with that. So it is a testament to earlier times that a lot of the workmanship dating back much earlier, and indeed Dymock does have traces right back to 925 years, which is what we celebrated last year. It is a building which is so intricate and detailed in many, many ways, but unfortunately the roof does need a lot of repairs, and it is always a struggle to find the finances for that.
Well, we're blessed with having so many beautiful churches. Do you think the government should step in and help rather than leaving it to the parishioners to struggle on year in, year out?
I fully subscribe to the German pattern where they have money taken or given to them through taxation. The community doesn't always fully appreciate their glorious buildings that they have within their communities until they realise that they are a part of the heritage of this country in particular, which should be preserved for so many purposes. We are very conscious of the fact that we want the community to use it in as many different ways as appropriate, and we do have an ever increasing use of activities organised by the community, and we want to make those events even more numerous and successful. So we also are building a toilet, which again a lot of buildings in this country don't, churches don't actually have. So this is all part and parcel of dragging the ecclesiastical buildings, which are so beautiful in this country but really are very much designed for days in the 19th century and not perhaps the 21st.
Dave Parks now reads a poem by Wilfred Gibson and one by Rupert Brooke.
The Golden Room, Wilfred Gibson. Do you remember that still summer evening when in the cosy cream-washed living room of the old nail shop we all talked and laughed? Our neighbours from the gallows, Catherine and Lascelles Abercrombie, Rupert Brooke, Eleanor and Robert Frost, living a while at Little Iddens, who brought over with them Helen and Edward Thomas. In the lamplight we talked and laughed, but for the most part listened while Robert Frost kept on and on and on in his slow New England fashion for our delight, holding us with shrewd turns and racy quips and the rare twinkle of his grave blue eyes. We sat there in the lamplight while the day died from rose-latticed casements and the plovers called over the low meadows till the owls answered them from the elms. We sat and talked. Now a quick flash from Abercrombie, now a murmured dry half-heard aside from Thomas, now a clear laughing word from Brooke, and then again Frost's rich and ripe philosophy that had the body and tang of good draught cider and poured as clear as stream. 'Twas in July of 1914 that we sat and talked. Then August brought the war and scattered us. Now on the crest of an Aegean isle, Brooke sleeps and dreams of England. Thomas lies 'neath Vimy Ridge, where he amongst his fellows died, just as life had touched his lips to song. And nigh as ruthlessly has life divided us who survive. For Abercrombie toils in a black northern town beneath the glare of hanging smoke, and in America Frost farms once more, and far from the old nail shop, we sojourn by the western sea. And yet was it for nothing that the little room, all golden in the lamplight, thrilled with golden laughter from hearts of friends that summer night. Darkness has fallen on it, and the shadow may never more be lifted from the hearts that went through those black years of war and live. And still, whenever men and women gather for talk and laughter on a summer's night, shall not that lamp rekindle, and the room glow once again alive with light and laughter, and like a singing star in time's abyss, burn golden-hearted through oblivion. Soldier, Rupert Brooke. If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. There shall be in that rich earth a richer dust concealed, a dust whom England bore, shaped, made aware, gave once her flower to love, her ways to roam, a body of England's, breathing English air, washed by the rivers, blessed by sons of home. And think this heart, all evil shed away, a pulse in the eternal mind, no less, gives somewhere back the thoughts by England given, her sights and sounds, dreams happy as her day, and laughter, learned of friends and gentleness in hearts at peace under an English heaven.
Thanks to David Parks there. an interview with a band now from the east of the country.
So we have with us Gordon Seabrook. Hello, Gordon.
Hello, Kirsty.
Thanks very much for joining us. Gordon Seabrook of the band Rough and Ready. Now, is that Rough and Ready or is it Rough and Ready?
But it's definitely Rough and Ready.
Right, yes. Okay. And Rough and Ready are an Irish folk band predominantly, is that correct?
We are an Irish folk band, although we do play a fairly eclectic mix of English folk, Irish folk and the occasional American folk as well.
So what do you do in the band?
I'm the guitarist and one of the vocalists in the band.
And does this come from a grand history of music on your behalf?
I played guitar a long, long time ago with some fairly famous people as a supporting band, people like Acca Bilk and Kenny Ball and his Jazzmen. But
so then the definition you have of fairly famous is quite broad then?
Well, they're fairly close together. Acca Bilk and Kenny Ball and his Jazzmen, yes. Yes.
Fantastic.
But then I had a 40-odd year layoff before I picked the guitar up again with Rough and Ready.
So that wasn't anything you did wrong?
No, no. I wasn't banned because I'd played with Acca Bilk and Kenny Ball and Jasmine.
Just the need to earn a wee bit more money.
Perhaps. Yes,
fantastic.
Yes.
So, Rough and Ready, you're based in the East Midlands.
We are. We're a Grantham-based band, although I don't think any of the seven members actually live in Grantham, apart from the violinist. So, and we're also classed as an Irish band, although there's only one member who's actually from Ireland, and he's lived in England since he was five.
And I understand that you've had a gig in Ireland as well?
We have indeed, yes, this year, 2012. We played out in Dublin towards the end of January. We played at a castle out in Dublin called Clontarf Castle.
So the musicians you have in your band, obviously you're on vocals and guitar.
Yes.
Could you do us a rundown of who else you have?
Yes, certainly. We have Simon, who's probably the longest-serving band member. He plays keyboards, piano accordion, penny whistle, and he's also vocalist. The youngest member of the band is our violin player, Matthew Cherry. He's only been with the band now for probably about 6 months, but he's learning how to make violins at college in Newark. We have Tim, who plays quite a lot of instruments, actually. He plays the banjo. He plays a little bit of mandolin. He also plays percussion, so he's on tambourine. He's on cymbals. We have two Baron players, that's the Irish handheld drum, single drum that's played with the stick.
Almost like a tambourine, I suppose you could say.
No, not like a tambourine, because they actually put their hand inside the drum and the hand is then used to push against and move up and down the skin whilst the drumming is done from the other side, and that gives it its different tones. Uh-huh. And in fact, they can play the drum all the way to the wooden rim, so the wooden rim shot's quite interesting as well.
A traditional Irish...
Yeah,
drum.
Yeah,
right.
Baron, spelt B-O-D-H-R-A-N. So we have two guys who play the bodhrán. That's Mickey McNulty, who's our only Irish member of the band. He's originally from County Mayo. And John Smith, who's actually from a local village just south of here. Newest member, Gary, plays the bass guitar.
But that's not all you perform with some of the time.
No, at our larger gigs, when we play in village halls and occasional theatre gigs, we take with us a group of dancers from the Grantham School of Dancing, who are known by the name the Irish Wolf Pack, and they have choreographed different styles of dancing. It's not that there's an Irish element to it, but it's not pure Irish dancing. So there's a mix of tap, Irish, there's also some acro, and a little bit of lyrical dancing.
So is there anything that's a wee bit more up-to-date that we might have heard of that you cover?
The band used to do some more rock and roll sort of numbers, but we tend not to do that these days. We tend to stick to the Irish folk and English folk and American folk songs.
Is it fair to say you get a good response from that?
People do seem to enjoy it, yes, and I think part of the reason for that is because the music that we play is fairly well known. Certainly people from Ireland will know all of the Irish songs, and therefore they can join in either with the singing and the clapping along or actually with the dancing as well. So, yeah, they tend to react very, very well. And it's that that we enjoy the most, the reaction from the crowd. We know that by involving the audience with the band, A, they'll enjoy the evening more, but B, so will we. But it's not always an easy thing to do because there are these barriers between us and the audience in the form of microphone stands and music stands and things like that. So one of the things that we're planning for the not too distant future is to try and dispense with some of those things.
So how long has the band been going?
The band will have been going for 7 years in January of next year, so almost 7 years now.
And whereabouts do you perform? Where might we be able to see Rough and Ready?
We have been fairly local, so we tend to operate in the Grantham area, although we have been as far east as the East Coast at a little village called Weybourne, or Webham as they call it down there. The gigs that we do tend to be in the Lincolnshire area, although we're trying to branch out more.
And you have plans to tour next year?
Well, we've just finished a theatre show at the Guildhall Arts Centre in Grantham, and so we've set in motion plans to do a theatre tour where we'll try and broaden the reach of Rough and Ready to some of the theatres in places like Spalding, Sleaford, Oundle, Newark, maybe even Lincoln. We like songs that are either about drinking or tell stories, and most of the stories that are told are about famine or pestilence
or drinking,
yes. But we also do funeral songs as well. So
the full range then?
The full range. And in fact, we have played at a funeral as well, which is not quite as dour as it might sound. It was actually quite an upbeat event. All of human life is here for Rough and Ready.
So if we want to know a little bit more about Rough and Ready, where do we go to?
I guess the easiest place to go to is the website, which can be found at www.irishhooley.com. That's Irish, as you would spell Irish, and Hooley, HOOLEY.com. Irish Hooley is all one word.
And do I take it you also have a Facebook page?
We definitely have a Facebook page under Rough and Ready, yes.
So that could be searched and found. So thank you very much, Gordon.
No, thank you, Kirsty.
This next song, this song tells the story about a young man growing up in Dublin back in the 50s and 60s. He was born south of the Liffey in an area of Dublin called Pimlico. And he was there, he fell in love with a girl from the Liberties. And he really, really loved his town, Dublin town. But slowly but surely, it grew to be a city. And after a while he said, I don't know that I can do this anymore. I think I'm just going to head off out. So he left Dublin. But whenever he's out for a drink or with friends, he likes to reminisce about Dublin in the rare old times. Raised on songs and stories, heroes of renown, the passing tales and glories that once was Dublin town. Hallowed halls and houses, the haunting children's rhymes, that once was part of Dublin in the rare old times. Ring-a-ring-a rosy, as the light declines, I remember Dublin City in the rare old times. My name it is Sean Dempsey, Dublin as can be, born hard and late in Pimlico, in a house that ceased to be. My trade I was a cooper, lost out to redundancy, like my house that fell to progress, my trade a memory. And I called it Peggy Dine, pretty as you please, a rogue and a child of Mary, from the rebel Liberties. I lost her to a student chap, with skin as black as coal, when he took her off to Birmingham. She
bells dimmed my brain, but Dublin keeps on changing, and nothing seems the same. The miller and the med have gone, the royal long since pulled down, as the grey unyielding concrete makes a city of my town. Ring-a-ring a rosy, as the light declines, I remember Dublin City in the rare old times. So fare thee well, sweet Annalise. I can no longer stay and watch the new glass cages spring up along the quay. My mind's too full of memories, too old to hear new chimes. I once was part. As the light declines, I remember Dublin City in the rare old times.
Tim Burrows is in the studio with a poem. Hello, Tim.
Yeah, it's Tim. This is my latest poem. I hope you enjoy it. It's called Reincarnated Carnations, or Oh, Why Am I So Shy? It's for Lou Reed. I want to shrug off this sacred carapace, this hoary shell, armour for the world, world round a tattooed tree with a serpent inside. The smoky mist of the dragon's breath, scaled seclusion in a garden of fools, garlands of thorns protecting the temple of the wary, a shrine of mist, columned cacophony in the silence of the brave, a sprinkling of ash in the ghats of the Ganges, bobbing candles in the tides of the good, incanted lamentation, sepulchred seclusion, at dawn in the world, a meeting of spirits at the edge of the fell, the cries of the fallen as they fall to hell, or the rise of the newborn, reincarnated carnations in the confetti of the dead. Thank you.
That's all from Backchat this week. Features were by Anthea Page, studio engineer was Adrian Petrosky, and producer was Anthea Page.
So it's goodbye from me, Kirsty Paul.
And me, James Amelia. Until next week, goodbye.
Goodbye.